Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of compelling legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed as legal advice. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. Please enjoy the program.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for the Ogletree Deacons Podcast. My name is Karen Tynan, and I'm a shareholder here in Sacramento, California. Here with me today is my favorite podcast partner, Kevin Bland, an Orange County shareholder. We're talking about the California COVID Prevention Plan and the Cal OSHA COVID Emergency Temporary Standard. This podcast is a super deep dive into the Cal OSHA COVID regulation, compliance, and best practices. And this is part one of a three-part series. It's going to take us three podcasts, isn't it, Kevin?
Yeah, it is. And maybe even four.
But
three for sure. We'll get it in three.
So, Kevin, let's start out talking about how we ended up with the emergency standard. How did we even get here in November?
Okay. Well, started out with a petition that was presented by labor, a couple labor organizations asking for asking for a permanent standard back in the day. And then come around November, the division and the standards board, ironically, the standards board staff said, no, we don't need one. We can cover it under the IAPP. Division staff won the battle and said, yeah, we're getting an emergency standard. So on what around November 20th or so?
Yep, 2020.
Of 2020, we get the draft and we have the big meeting.
I think it was like a Thursday, and you and I spent the next 3 days pretty like crazy reviewing.
It was right before Thanksgiving. So then on November 30th, the draft went to the OL and they adopted it on November 30th. So this became an effective standard in a very, very short period of time. And so everyone had to scramble at that point to become compliant with the standard. And now what we're going to talk about today is what did that standard have in it? What were folks trying to do to comply with it? What do we need to do to comply with it? And it's a very complicated, I think it's five sections long, dealing with COVID outbreaks, right, major outbreaks, housing, transportation, and about 28 pages of text. And so we'll try to condense that for everyone today. We'll see how we do, huh, Karen?
Yeah. And I think that many California employers ended up, I'd say, almost a little flat-footed, right? It happened so quickly. We knew it was coming. But come November 30th, I know you and I, if I got on a Zoom call with an employer for an hour, I would get off a Zoom call and I'd have about 50 emails. It was impossible to keep up.
It was a crazy time. There's a lot of confusion because let's face it, everyone had been working on COVID in their workplaces since April, May of 2020. And so there was a little bit of confusion of, wait a minute, we already have COVID plans. We already have COVID plans. We're already doing all this stuff. What happened? And then, of course, they changed enough to where it could create some problems. And I think when we go through this, you'll see some of the things you probably were already doing. It needs to just be repackaged. And some of the things that are new and some of the definitions of things we'll probably talk about.
And later, people had been following that California employer playbook. And I had many people say, oh, I'm up to date. I'm following the playbook. And I said, Well,
and following the CDC to a T, I'm like, we're good. Well, not anymore. I ironically, and I know this is a little bit of a side, we only have 20 minutes, but I just said in 3 days of the Cal OSHA Advisory Committee, I happen to be a member of, one of 40 folks and one of maybe about 15 employer reps out of that 40. And there was a lot of discussion about where they don't agree with what the CDC is saying. You know, we had some CDHP folks, California Department of Health, you know, they fell short of saying they were absolutely wrong, but there was some information that they disagreed with. And so now that's something that we have to think about as we're compliant with this, if you've been following CDC.
Right. So here we are in 2021. We're required to have a COVID prevention plan. You call it the
CPP, although that kind of fell aside and now everyone's calling it the ETS.
For emergency temporary standard, yeah. But seriously, because you have an IIPP, you have a heat illness plan, it makes sense. You've got a COVID prevention plan,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. IIPP, HIPP, and now CPP.
We California employers, we have to have this plan. What are we required to do under this plan? I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the required elements, implementation, and kind of that 50,000 foot view of the CPP, Kev.
Absolutely. Well, kind of like the IIPP, for those of you that have practiced in California for a long time, have businesses, you've always had to have your injury and illness prevention plan. It has to have been right. 8 core elements. Well, what do we have here? Have a COVID prevention plan. Has, I want to say, 11 elements, and it has to be in writing. The elements or something like, you know, you have to have a communication portion. You have to have an identification and evaluation of hazards, but of COVID right. hazards, very similar, sound familiar, right? A training component, an investigation component, a correction of hazards. So you find something's failing in your hazard program.
Just like the
IIPP. Yeah, just like the IIPP. And it goes on with 11 segments, including record keeping, which is a big issue. We'll talk about some exclusion from work provisions that are in there and things like that. But you have to have that. And then the key is that implementation, right? You have it in writing, and it's perfect in writing. Are you implementing? What are you doing, right, with it? Do you have other ancillary forms that help you comply with what you have in your written program? Are you communicating that to your employees? Are you training your employees on that? So documentation is a big, big component of this, because if something, maybe you did something, let's say you're doing a close contact check, a tracing thing. If you're not writing down what you're doing about it, it didn't happen in their mind, even
we
though
can't
it did.
Prove it. We can't prove we did it.
Yeah. So that's a biggie. So documentation. If we're talking about some of the big picture best practices, the easy one in my mind is have that written program and make sure it's tight and follows to a T what the regulation requires.
Yes.
That's half your battle. And then the next part of the battle, making sure that you're doing the training and getting all the notices to everyone. Because I think of it this way. The easy pickings for Cal OSHA is documentation. It doesn't say what we told you it had to say, right?
Yes.
And then the next thing is, well, are you doing what your program says? So making sure you have folks that understand how to do their close contact tracing, how to give the notices, who gets the notices. I know there's a whole probably section that we'll do that may be 20 minutes long on notices alone, because we fold in other elements of that. And making sure you close the loop on your things. If this was not work-related, make sure you have evidence of that. You can't just say Susie called and said, hey, Tommy said he was at the grocery store. Okay, that's not work-related. You know, make sure you close the loop out on that.
Documentation and making sure that if you receive that document request from an inspector or you had to, you know, step up and provide proof of your CPP, you better be able to have it a click away, as I say.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And accessible. That's a very good.
A lot of people are putting it on their intranet. Mm-hmm. I think that's helpful. And I know you represent a lot of construction companies. Mm-hmm. And they have those iPads like in the foreman's truck. I'm seeing people putting it on the iPad so they can make sure it's out at the work site. Some people are also posting it. Things like that that I think are pretty helpful. That the one thing I like when we do our webinars is that we get a lot of feedback from clients and people in California about what they're doing, and they share their ideas.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. I think I've learned more from clients and the way they've looked at this and what they've decided to do that has benefited me more than what I benefited them, you know, and then we pull all that together because there's a lot of great ideas out there on implementation. We try to share those as we go through these podcasts and the webinars we do because we're learning new things every day, just like we're learning new things about COVID every day.
Right. Let's get to COVID exposure, because that is one of the linchpins dealing with COVID exposure and addressing COVID exposures in the workplace. And you and I, it's a foundation of a lot of the webinars we do. What is COVID exposure and what are the important definitions for people to look at in that part of the prevention plan that addresses COVID exposure?
Sure. So one of the most important ones, and ironically, they don't call it close contact, right?
Right.
They call it COVID exposure, but basically COVID exposure is close contact. Now, how are they defining COVID exposure? It's an exposure to a COVID case, which means, there's the definition of COVID case, which means someone that has COVID in the workplace, COVID-19 is tested positive and it's a known COVID case. If you're within 6 feet of that individual for 15 minutes, cumulative over a 24-hour period, you are considered exposed to COVID. That's a COVID exposure. I like to call it close contact. There is some movement, as an aside, from the advisory committee to change that to what it is, close contact. Yeah, tracing. And so there are provisions that come with that definition. We'll talk about a little bit more depth later, like exclusion from the workplace for a period of time. But so that's an important one. What is close contact? They have defined it, the 6-15-24 rule, which you coined, Karen, and I love that. So that's one definition that I think is very important because it does get confusing. So the other definition is with workplace. And workplace is defined as basically a work area, an area within your workplace, a work site. It has this big, long definition that covers a bunch of different things. Now, to a point on this is that your workplace doesn't necessarily mean everybody in it. So the idea, we're going to get to this in a minute. I may ask you to talk about some zones or things, but just as we're getting there, this is another issue that came up in this 3-day meeting is wanting to define work group as opposed to workplace. And so creating subsets of, for lack of a better, clusters, right?
Right.
And so that it can help you manage and narrow that down. But right now, as it's written, it's relatively broad. There are some FAQs that go into this definition.
Good point.
Yeah, it talks about, I call it transitory contact. I think they use a different word in there. But basically, if you're walking through the hall next to someone, that hallway doesn't necessarily become part of the exposed workplace, right?
Right. Because Kalosha defines it as a location. Mm-hmm. And so what you're saying is at the advisory committee level, instead of defining exposure as a geographic location, we're looking more to define it as a group of people, as employees who may work together in a particular line. Is that it?
Yeah. And in the background of that, if you will, they're recognizing that most contagion is based on people and less on place. There is some, surface areas and things, but what's in the air where the people are that have COVID or a person is seems to be the broader transmission vehicle. And so they're starting to recognize that.
I think that's important because since before November 30th, we've been working with lots of employers in California helping define, for example, a big distribution center. And we'll have zone 1, zone 2, zone 3, or the blue zone and the purple zone. And people in the purple zone don't go in the blue zone. And trying to compartmentalize people, I think that's been pretty effective. And it's looking like that's where Kalosha is recognizing a better analysis.
Yeah, and it's good. And to the construction point, we could have 50 houses being built on a track. If you took this broad workplace, you could have someone on housing lot 1 and housing lot 38 that they've never even seen. They don't even know who they are.
Right.
And so it does help in that context, which is not to pat ourselves on the back, but I'm going to a little bit here, is that we kind of started early on in narrowing this through the definition that existed to work groups. We just didn't call it work groups. So so a lot of folks, if you're listening to this and you've had our advice before, we feel like that's going to be codified, and it was the way Kalosha was looking at it. So
That looks like the trend for 2021, that Kalosha is definitely looking more at the working area of employees who are together.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So exposure forms the foundation of probably, I'd say, half of the questions you and I were getting in December and January about notices.
Yeah. Before we get to notices, I apologize. I missed one important point on this COVID exposure, the 6/15/24. It has to be during the high risk exposure period. And I think that's important for people to recognize. And that's basically 2 days before either the test date, if they're asymptomatic, or 2 days before the symptoms occurred and 10 days after. But once they've been on the place and they have symptoms, they're out anyway. So that tail doesn't matter as much in my mind. But I just want to make sure the folks knew that. Sure. Sorry about that.
No, well, that's important when we talk about the notices, because if Kevin comes to work on Wednesday and says sometime during the day, hey, I'm not feeling well, he started to have his symptoms on Wednesday, doesn't matter who he really worked with last Friday.
Exactly.
Right? 5 days ago.
Exactly.
And sometimes that it can be an issue in communicating the notices, because the people he worked with last Friday wonder, well, why aren't I getting a notice? The people he worked with on Tuesday and Wednesday and maybe even Monday are getting notices.
Right.
Of the exposure, but not Friday. And so with the 3205 notices, let's call them the ETS notices, as many people are.
Is there more than one notice, Karen?
The AB 685 notices. California decided to have a very uncoordinated approach to notices. Would you agree, Kev?
Yes, I would definitely agree with that. Uncoordinated is a polite way to put it.
So for your CPP notices that are required under Section 3205C3B3, you've got to give notice of COVID exposure within 1 day. Now, Kevin, I know the regulation language is pretty simple. What are you seeing in the notices, and how are people handling the notices in California?
So there's some required components of the notice. And we're talking about the ETS or CPP notice, not the AB 685 notice. We'll get to that.
That's important.
Yeah, an important distinction. So you're only notifying your close contact folks, right?
Right.
Who had close contact? And if you think about it, what do they need to know, right? So they need to know that they need to get tested. So, and they need to know that the employer is going to pay for that, and they need to know where to go. That's important for that to be in there. They need to know that they're going to be excluded from work for the period of 10 days under the executive order, 14 days under the reg. We'll get to that. But they need to know that. They need to know who to contact in HR regarding their pay.
Right.
And what pay they may have. So their benefits information and pay information needs to be in that notice. Now, it's very important in these notices not to say, hey, you were in contact with Johnny on Tuesday, right? Because you still have to maintain privacy. But those are the big points that have to be. Now, an interesting aside, it doesn't say it has to be in writing, where AB 685 says their notices have to be in writing. But I'm telling you, it needs to be in writing, right? Because if it's not in writing, it didn't happen. Now, when I say that, because this is an important part to reduce spread, right? So it may be that you make a phone call and follow it up with a note. Because when you've got this, you may have talked to them, but followed up with a written notice to them. Because part of the tracing may be a conversation with the person, even trying to find out if they are close contact, right?
Right. And let me ask you this, as a beat up old iron worker union member, do the unions play any role in these notices? Do they get anything?
Yes. You have to provide basically the same information, keeping the identity concealed if they are a member. So let's give an example. You have the Teamsters Union folks, you have the Ironworkers Union, and you have the Plumbers Union, all under your purview. You don't have to give, if it's an ironworker, you give the Ironworkers Union. If it's a Teamster, you don't have to give the Ironworkers Union, you give the Teamster. So they have to be under that collective bargaining agreement that particular employee. Yeah.
Now, that's a good distinction. And then for those people on a multi-employer work site, like you're talking about, where there are other independent contractors, there are notice requirements. it's just important for this to be in your CPP. There are a ton of resources. And I think the most important part of notices is to get them right.
Yeah.
It's an easy citation. It's an easy violation if you're not getting it right. Why serve yourself up that way?
No, exactly. Because this was an easy thing to comply with. When I say easy, to get the writing right, and not to give a sales pitch for us, but we have a templates out there that you can get through the firm if you're a client that has these forms already created, that has a lot of, it's going to tick off all the information. If you fill in the blank for stuff that applies to your particular company, and that can go a long way. We've had a lot of folks benefit from those templates.
Yeah, I like those. And then let's close out this podcast with a training question. This is a question we get quite a bit, because referencing your comment at the beginning of this podcast, we've been dealing with COVID, training on it, sanitizing, face coverings, all that since March, April-ish. So we've got these training topics in our CPP. What if we did training back in the summer? What if we did training online? What if we did training in some PowerPoints that were shared in Zoom? How do we address that, Kev?
Well, here's the way to look at it, is there's a few extra things you may have to train on, but that training still counts. Let's say you had driver training on a forklift, and then you get a new forklift that has left-hand controls instead of right-hand controls. Well, everything else is the same. You're going to train the different controls on the forklift. Same concept here, right? Uh-huh. If you're a lot of your policies, like wear a mask, social distance, pre-screen check, all of those things that you trained on are probably the same even under this list.
Yes.
They probably haven't changed. And so that training is going to count. There's some additional training about benefits, your written program, who to talk to that may have changed. You're going to have to update that training and document that. But it isn't that all the training you did, you don't have to start from scratch, in my mind,
yes.
Because as long as you've got it documented that here's the training they had on May 1st, here's the additional training they had on December 1st regarding this new regulation.
Great answer. And I think that makes this regulation seem just a skosh less overwhelming.
Yes. Yeah. I want to close with this too, and especially if folks are listening to this that maybe on the labor side, is that what I found overwhelmingly, and I think you found the same thing, is that the employers are really wanting to comply and do the right thing and protect their employees from COVID the best they can when it's under their purview. Although it's a community
yes.
spread issue, they want to do what they can. So my hat's off, frankly, to the
yes.
employer community here in California, is how hard they've worked. How much they've done to try to comply, and then some that even go beyond the compliance.
Right.
So I just wanted to give a big shout out to our employers out there.
That's fair, Kev. And so everybody, thanks for listening to Karen and Kevin. Look for our blog articles on ogletree.com. Also, there are quite a few recorded webinars related to COVID-19 and the CPP. We have other workplace podcasts. We've got a primer on Cal OSHA. We did some podcast in early 2020, podcast on Cal OSHA hearings, just quite a bit of information out there for everybody. And so we want you to take care and stay safe.
Stay safe, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.